Choke Let's points. King County Metro is preparing to charge fares again, and there are service changes going into effect over the weekend. Chris Sullivan has the roundup.
Metro has targeted October 1st as the date it would like to start charging fares again. It stopped collecting them in March as a way to keep drivers and passengers separated for social distancing. But before the fares can be charged, Metro has to install automated plexiglass safety partitions that are activated when the front door is open.
We are about 700 partitions installed and counting. We are, of course, rolling them out across the whole fleet and really committing to that measure as a safety measure to protect the health of our operators as well as customers as we look to resume people boarding through the front door.
Metro's Katie Chalmers says 1,400 of these unique partitions will be installed by October. The agency's also installing onboard mask dispensers on 100 buses on the busiest routes. Ridership is still off about 60% from this time last year, but Chalmers says riders are slowly coming back.
We just have our first several days over 150,000 boardings a day, so we are seeing a steady uptick in ridership, and we will be watching that closely as the fall goes on.
Service changes coming over the weekend and on Monday should help those ridership numbers. Metro is restoring service to transportation-starved West Seattle with the bridge out of commission. Service will return to nearly full pre-COVID levels out of the neighborhood.
Even though we know that our demand for travel in the peak periods into downtown Seattle is still low, we know that West Seattle is of particular importance in trying to make sure there's really solid transit options available.
Metro is also rolling out a new route serving Renton, Kent, and Auburn.
We are putting a new frequent route in place that will, over the next several years, be transformed to become one of our next rapid ride lines.
But overall, Metro will still be operating at 85% of pre-COVID capacity. Some evening and weekend service will be reduced into and through Seattle to help meet actual demand. And Chalmers says Metro is trying to stay as flexible as possible to try to put service where it really sees actual demand.
A lot of our focus is on continuing recovering from COVID, trying to then throughout the service change watch closely to see where are people riding, where are the most customers coming back to Metro, and trying to be as responsive as we can to make sure that service is there to welcome them back.
Metro is still facing a huge budget hole because of the pandemic. It expects to collect $465 million fewer dollars in sales tax revenue over the next 2 years than it forecasted. It expects to collect $130 to $150 million fewer dollars at the fare box. Latest projections have Metro facing a more than $2 billion budget gap through 2028.
So there are going to be new partitions that swing into place when the door opens?
Yep, they're plexiglass. Wow. They're actually designed by people at Metro. And no one else is doing this kind of technology.
Yeah, I was just doing a quick Google search. I didn't see anything like that anywhere else.
Yeah, so they swing into place, and then the driver can actually keep them there while the coach is in motion. So there'd be a little barrier to actually approaching the driver while the bus is in motion, too. So, yeah, it's a really unique solution.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's talk about Seattle's business community and what its future is going to be. There are small business owners who are very worried that because of the epidemic, the business atmosphere, the general feeling of security in Seattle's various business neighborhoods has gone downhill, and they want to do something about it. So there are now, I believe, over 500 signatures on this pledge being sent to the city council, Aaron?
I think we're a little over 530 right now. We continue to see people add on to the pledge.
Aaron Goodman is the executive director of the SoDo Business Improvement Area. And also with us is Mike Stewart, who's the executive director of the Ballard Alliance, representing small businesses in Ballard. So, Aaron, why don't you begin? What does the pledge ask of the city council? And why did you feel this approach was necessary?
We're really concerned right now with an uptick in crime. And we need to make sure that businesses can operate, that their employees feel safe coming and going, and that customers feel safe coming back to these businesses.
Well, I mean, you've been concerned about this for years, haven't you? I mean, there's been an ongoing homelessness problem that I know you've asked the city council to address. Is there some reason for doing this now? Has it gotten worse?
It certainly has gotten worse. We have seen a change in the city policies due to the pandemic that has created an environment where, you know, we're not addressing these issues.
Mike, for Ballard, which you represent, what do you face there?
You know, we have a fantastic restaurant district who are surviving and getting through by having outdoor cafes. And so these customers are out on the street. And when we have those customers being harassed, instances of individuals spitting on customers while they're in the street, those are the kinds of things that we just can't tolerate that really have been going on for quite some time. But I think that now, as we're trying to struggle and survive to get by, it's really been ratcheted up a notch, I think.
So then, in terms of addressing these safety concerns, are you going against the defund the police movement? Are you asking for more police?
No, absolutely not. In fact, we feel that this safety pledge is very complementary to that movement. We are not being prescriptive or calling for more police. We're saying this is what safety looks like for our business districts.
Now, this is all wrapped up in a racial equity issue. So I have to point out that both of you are white. Do you then represent just white businesses, or are these signatories from a diverse background?
These signatories are from a diverse background. We represent, in SOTO, a wide range of businesses that are owned by a diverse group of people. When you're looking at a small restaurant supply business that's we have here in SOTO that's owned by a Chinese family, and they are, English is not their first language, and they struggle with how to access the help that they need, we're here to provide that voice for them to City Council.
Are you going to make a some sort of presentation to the council that involves actual small business owners, or is it just a letter? What happens once you've signed this letter and sent it in?
You know, the first thing that we want to do is we want to encourage City Council members to sign on to the pledge. We need them to review this document and be willing to address these issues, especially as we head into the budget cycle for 2021. These are going to be important conversations that need to be had.
You know, during this time of COVID, when most people are working from home, it's not a time which people are seeing what's going on the streets. And so we have created a socially distanced model for a tour. And we'd really like our city leaders to come into our neighborhoods and see firsthand what our businesses are dealing with. Talk to our small business owners.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think I've been to Seattle maybe once, twice since March. So I mean, and the times I went down there, frankly, it looks so sad with businesses still boarded up and basically deserted. So has anybody actually taken a look and started talking to business owners in a serious way?
I think, you know, city council members have done some bit of outreach, you know, but from our vantage point, Dave, just being super candid, I don't think it's enough right now. Mm-hmm. We've got, you know, businesses who are trying to make it through this economic crisis. And if we allow our neighborhood business districts to devolve into, you know, disarray, that is really going to throttle back the ability for existing businesses to survive and the ability for new entrepreneurs who are looking to open up a business, impede their ability to be able to do that as well.
Yeah. That's Mike Stewart, the executive director of the Ballard Alliance, and Aaron Goodman, the executive director of the SOTO Business Improvement Area. They have hundreds of signatures on this pledge. They've sent it to the city council, and you're waiting for the response. Thank you both. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave.
7:21 Seattle's Morning News. We have traffic coming up. Let's get back to Attorney General William Barr for a moment. On top of the report of the New York Times that he wants to pursue sedition charges against protesters and that he's looking into criminal charges against Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin over the Chaz Chop Zone, he made a few more choice comments last night. Here's the report.
Putting a national lockdown, stay-at-home orders, is like house arrest.
At a conservative Constitution Day event in Virginia last night, Attorney General Bill Barr said this of quarantining nationwide.
It's, you know, other than slavery, which was a different kind of restraint, this is the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history.
Barr suggested that politicians, not medical professionals, should guide the public during the pandemic.
A person in the white coat is not the grand seer who can come up with the right decision for society. A free people makes its decision through its elected representative.
In the wide-ranging discussion, Barr also criticized the Black Lives Matter movement.
Proposition, who can quarrel with the proposition Black Lives Matter, but they're not interested in black lives. They're interested in props. A small number of blacks who were killed by police during conflict with police, usually less than a dozen a year, who they can use as props to achieve a much broader political agenda.
But the data shows that 250 black people were killed by police last year alone. Black people are more than three times more likely to be killed during a police encounter than white people. The attorney general also seemed to take aim at some of his own people.
Our prosecutors have all too often inserted themselves into the political process based on the flimsiest of legal theories.
Barr criticized his prosecutors for political headhunting and defended criticism that he ever interfered in cases involving close associates of the president, like Roger Stone and Michael Flynn.
Letting the most junior members set the agenda might be a good philosophy for a Montessori preschool, but it is no way to run a federal agency.
And then denied he's ever interfered on Mr. Trump's behalf.
And I'm saying, what do you mean by interfere? Under the law, all prosecutorial power is vested in the attorney general. And these people are agents of the attorney general. And as I say to FBI agents, whose agent do you think you are? Now, I don't say this in a pompous way, but that is the chain of authority and legitimacy in the Department of Justice.
Attorney General William Barr.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. It's about doing everything for mom after years of her caring for you. A family in Australia, stuck at home due to the pandemic, like the rest of us, pulled off a spectacular surprise for their 87-year-old mother, who has Alzheimer's and vascular dementia.
One of my favorite memories as a kid is my mum and dad used to take me down to the big Sydney Aquarium twice a year. We'd sit there all day long with a packed lunch, and we just marvel at the aquarium display.
A beloved childhood memory. What Jason Van Genderen wanted to do was recreate that wonderful aquarium memory for his mother, even though he knew the memory would only last a few hours for her. So he and his siblings turned a few of the larger windows on her home into something that they could project video of fish swimming in a large aquarium. They set up a beautiful outdoor space for her to sit and enjoy the sights, and then surprised her.
I've got a little surprise for you outside. I've got a little surprise for you.
Oh.
All right. Hang on a second. When I was a little kid,
yeah. You
and Dad used to take me down to the big aquarium in Sydney.
Oh.
Keep watching the windows. Rightio, guys, open up the curtains.
Swelling music ensues. She's clearly enjoying it. This isn't the first special event they've planned for her, too. They've also recreated the experience of shopping in a grocery store. They're doing this because self-isolation can be often worsen symptoms of Alzheimer's and dementia, so they're trying to help her as much as possible while also, you know, paying tribute to the love that she showed them.
Yeah, nice gesture.
Yeah.
Here is G. Scott himself. Is it okay if I run some of the Attorney General's comments past you this morning?
Do you have to? Yeah, okay.
I don't have to.
Yeah, go ahead.
But I am interested to hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah, okay, what do you got?
So we're speaking at a Constitution Day event at Hillsdale College it's a Christian college in Michigan last night. And the Attorney General, William Barr, talked about the lockdowns that we've seen since the pandemic hit.
Putting a national lockdown, stay-at-home orders, is like house arrest. Other than slavery, which was a different kind of restraint, this is the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history.
And then he went on to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement. Here's what he said about that.
The proposition, who can quarrel with the proposition Black Lives Matter, but they're not interested in black lives. They're interested in props. A small number of blacks who were killed by police during conflict with police, usually less than a dozen a year, who they can use as props to achieve a much broader political agenda.
Okay, let's just first break down what he said, and I want to go back to the at least a dozen a year, the way he puts that. First, does Jim Crow ring a bell for anyone? That was a rough time. How about internment of Japanese Americans? That happened here on this soil. I can go keep going. Dave, when you start to equate human bondage with a measure aimed at saving lives, like the lockdown that we had or in this pandemic, that's pretty sad. And you know, I can expect that coming from, like, the person down the street, or maybe the teacher who's been teaching for too long. But right now, these comments are being made by public figures in the highest office. And it's disappointing. And anyone who loves democracy, anybody that loves government and the ideals that it provides out there, you have to admit that there is an attack on that. And you have to understand that the reasons that we are having the problems in our country right now is because attitude reflects leadership. And so while it hurts for that to happen, it hurts any time to hear something like that, right? But what really hurts is there are so many people in our country that hear something like that and get riled up, and they say, yeah, and they get excited about something like that. It's really sad.
I just wish people, and maybe you agree with, maybe you don't, but I just wish people, and especially public figures, would stop the slavery comparisons, would stop the Nazi comparisons, would stop the Holocaust comparisons, the 9/11 comparisons. Those events are like none other. You cannot, especially as a white American, compare anything affecting you to slavery. I think we should stop equating certain things to Holocaust levels of horror or 9/11 levels of death. It's just, it's untoward and unnecessary. Those are untouchable events that are sacred and horrid and cannot be compared to anything in present day.
It's when he said that there was a slavery was a different type of restraint. That wasn't a restraint. That's one of the worst crimes in humanity.
Right.
Not just in the U.S. in humanity, one of the worst crimes ever committed. So when you throw that word out, slavery, I don't think a lot of times when they throw that word out, maybe they don't really understand what they're talking about. Maybe they just, they look at the movies that they have seen. I'm not saying I was there either. But if you truly dig deep into the history of what happened and understand, like, atrocities happen. I'm not just talking about, hey, you have to work in my fields and you have to do what I say and I'll whip you if you get out of line. No. I'm talking about the ugly side of things. I'm talking about one of the conversations that my mom and I had. We were talking about how sometimes affection, like in my family, right? Affection is not that great. We're not really great at saying we love you and hugs and everything. We love each other, but it doesn't happen that often. Well, you want to go back to what happened in slavery times when the reasons why sometimes affection was not showed amongst their children or amongst their spouse because they didn't want the master to maybe sell away one of their family. So they want to make it seem like, oh, there's really not that much love. So we talk about the deepness of those things. And so I don't want to get too emotional and passionate about this. But when you start throwing that word out, especially someone in a high office like that, it's disappointing.
G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock, Cairo Radio. Thank you, G. Seattle's Morning News. Change is in the air after a summer of protest. The King County leadership is detailing a series of new programs to help answer some of the demands of the demonstrators. With the report, Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
King County Executive Dale Constantine says the summer has created an opportunity when he feels a sense of urgency to act on.
Here we are today with this conversation having broken out onto the national stage, and white America in particular suddenly realizing that there's something they've been missing here. It is a chance for this government and more broadly this entire community to find a way to begin dismantling the racism that is really wrapped not just into criminal legal system or governmental institutions, but to all institutions in our society. I feel a real need for us to act before this window closes.
To that end, Constantine announcing a series of changes in new programs and investments to make significant racial justice reforms.
I'm proposing to reallocate $4.6 million in marijuana tax revenues from the King County Sheriff's Office and transfer those monies to community-based programs. Since the legalization of marijuana, King County has received a portion of the retail excise tax and directed that money to law enforcement. It's time to shift those resources to other uses that directly benefit communities. And I'm proposing spending $2.8 million to help people vacate previous marijuana convictions that make it harder to get employment and housing. It is a fact that Black communities have historically and still currently been disproportionately harmed by our nation's war on drugs. And this begins to undo some of that harm.
And
a novel program that was conceptualized and developed by community organizations. In lieu of filing juvenile charges, King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office will refer up to 800 young people each year to receive comprehensive community-based services. We're calling this program Restorative Community Pathways. And its funding of $6.2 million includes services and support for those who have been harmed, as well as restitution to help undo the harm caused. My office will also be working with Prosecutor Satterberg on another effort, providing community-based services instead of filing charges against some 1,000 adults who face their first nonviolent offenses, including misdemeanors and felonies.
King County Public Health Director Patty Hayes says racism is a public health crisis, as is gun violence, especially when it comes to young people from communities of color.
One third of the 68 homicide victims were young people killed by gunfire. They were between the ages of 16 and 25. And Harborview Medical Center treated 108 gunshot patients between May and July this year. About one in five were under the age of 19. We already know that historically, 90% of reported firearm violence has largely been concentrated within South King County, with Black and African-American boys and young men.
So she's got another new proposal.
The executive's proposed budget invests $600,000 in a coalition-based approach to end this epidemic, focused on the needs of Black and African-American boys and young men in particular. And with everyone's efforts, we will implement a comprehensive strategic plan to prevent gun violence across the region. Our department's Zero Youth Detention Team will be the county's lead for this work.
Marlon Brown with Black Lives Matter Seattle King County applauding these moves.
We're grateful for the steps that this proposed budget takes. It is a moral decision to begin taking steps toward righting historic wrongs. It is a moral decision to put measures in place that will change Black lives. The priorities presented today will begin to address some of the injustices the Black community and other communities of color have experienced for decades in King County.
But the King County Sheriff slamming the executive for not consulting her on these proposals and is now wondering what this shift in investments will mean for her department. She says a loss of dollars from the marijuana revenue could amount to the loss of dozens of deputies who respond to 911 calls in unincorporated parts of the county.
Car Radio's Hannah Scott.
You can ring my bell, Rachel Bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And everybody talks about sending people to Mars, but what about Venus? Where's the love for Venus? It's the planet of love. Let's go to Rachel Bell, who's been...
reporting live from Venus.
Reporting. You know, what a get that would be.
How's my signal coming through?
Here she is, live from Venus. It sounds pretty darn good.
Oh, great. So, yeah, on Monday, in case you missed this big news drop, a group of astronomers announced that there may be life on Venus, and they used powerful telescopes to detect phosphine in the planet's atmosphere.
The molecule is not itself alive. It's just four atoms of phosphorus and three hydrogens. The reason why much is being made of it is because there is no known way to produce phosphine on a terrestrial planet, which does not involve living things.
Okay, so that's my friend, Dr. Sarah Ballard. She is a professor of astronomy at the University of Florida. And I like to brag about her because she discovered four new planets before she turned 30.
Wow.
And she did some of that work right here in Seattle at the University of Washington. She was a Carl Sagan Fellow. So the reason I specifically wanted to interview her, not just because she's my friend, is because she has a different opinion than most astronomers on what we should do with this new information about the possibility of life on Venus. Most astronomers seem to be anxious to start studying the planet further, to put all the money into this, to start sending whatever you call them, spaceships out there to get samples. Yeah. But she thinks that we need to slow down and consider the ethical consequences.
I have an unusual position among scientists in that I think it likely is life and we shouldn't go. I think most scientists are in the opposite corner where they think it isn't life and we should go, you know, to understand what kind of exotic chemistry is going on. There's two reasons for why I'm very hesitant to jump right in and go. One of them is because it's almost impossible not to contaminate Venus with Earth life if we send spacecraft. Now, we already have. There have been spacecraft that have visited Venus and gone even to the surface of Venus, where they were immediately crushed and destroyed. Venus is not particularly habitable. However, even putting something into space, there can still be living things on it. It is extremely hard to kill all organisms on Earth, even in the vacuum of space. Things can stay alive, like tardigrades, for example. It's almost impossible to kill them. So that means almost certainly, if we sent a spacecraft, the risk would not be zero, that we are putting life into a situation which right now might be pristine. The second reason is because, did you ever watch any Star Trek, Rachel?
No, I'm not that way.
I haven't watched that much Star Trek either. I'm much more of a Star Wars person. In Star Trek, there's something called the Prime Directive, which is basically a moral position about how you shouldn't interfere with developing civilizations. It should be treated as a nature preserve, basically. There's something ethical about it.
Dr. Ballard thinks we need to be careful that we don't use curiosity as the reason to justify actions that might harm or destroy life on Venus or any other place in the solar system.
We have a really mixed history on Earth of using science to justify entry into spaces where we weren't before. I also think that the question of whether we should go shouldn't just be a scientific question. I don't know. I think it's a question that everyone should weigh in on, not only because taxpayer dollars fund NASA, but also because I think it is an enormously moral question, which extends beyond what scientists can answer, which is, have we reckoned with our own history enough to feel like it's moral to go to another planet where there might be life and interfere with it? And yet, nobody is more voraciously curious than me about what it is and whether it has DNA. Nobody wants to know more than me. But the fact that I have such a strong investment and such a strong bias toward wanting to understand it means I need to be that much more careful at interrogating my motivation.
She also points out that phosphine is incredibly toxic to humans. We do have it here on Earth, and we are actually extremely toxic to phosphine. So if we did send something, all the research would have to be done in the atmosphere out near Venus, and it would be all artificial intelligence. They would not be sending people to do this mission.
Well, I'm glad she's thinking that way. I wish more scientists had thought that way before they invented the nuclear bomb, for example. You have some very cool friends, by the way.
I have to admit that is true. And this is one of my smartiest, pantsest friends, and I'm so proud of her. So I'm always really happy to feature her on the radio because it's called Shine Theory, this theory that was thought up by these two women who have a podcast called Call Your Girlfriend. It's all about supporting your friends, supporting your girlfriends, and the idea that if you don't make them shine, then you cannot shine yourself.
Makes sense. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.